Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. April Ryan has covered the news for decades, but it wasn't until recently that she became part of it. April has been White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Networks for 20 years, covering the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and now Trump administrations, and she contributes to CNN as a political analyst. You might know April from one of her notable interactions this year, which included an exchange with President Trump in which he asked her whether the Congressional Black Caucus were her friends and whether she could set up a meeting with them, and also an exchange with Sean Spicer, in which he told April to stop shaking her head as he answered a question from her. That exchange with Spicer, along with comments Bill O'Reilly made about Congresswoman Maxine Waters' hair, helped fuel a Black Women at Work hashtag on Twitter and in part thrust April into the spotlight. April has written two books, The Presidency in Black and White, My Up-Close View of Three Presidents and Race in America, and At Mama's Knee, Mothers and Race in Black and White. And she was named 2017's Journalist of the Year by the National Association of Black Journalists. We talked about specialty media, how the national conversation around race has evolved, and whether her role has changed in covering Trump's administration. Here's our conversation. So I think many people probably associate you with Washington, but they might not know you are originally from Baltimore and still live here, right?
I still live in the area, very much so. I scoot around downtown sometimes on the weekends, and people are like, is that her? I'm like, keep my head down. But yeah, I'm still here.
What part of Baltimore are you originally from?
It depends upon what time in my life. I grew up in Northwest Baltimore. Early on, I was born in Northwest Baltimore, I must say. Then we moved in my second grade year to Northeast Baltimore. Then in my sophomore year in high school, we moved to Baltimore County. So, I've been around.
You've been done a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. Why have you stayed in Baltimore?
Because my family's here. And when you're from Baltimore, I find this with everyone. You don't want to leave. It's something that pulls you here and keeps you here. It's a magnet. It's this imaginary magnet that keeps you here. I love Baltimore. I really do. I've lived in other places. I've traveled to other places. But Baltimore is my home. It's real. It's neighborhoods. It's my family, my friends. It's where I got my start. Just up the road, I used to do gospel radio on Charles Street, WBGR, when I was in college. So Baltimore holds a lot for me, and my children love it here as well.
Was gospel your introduction to radio?
No, jazz was. News and jazz at WEAA in Baltimore, at Morgan State. And I've done a lot. I've done jazz, gospel, news, R&B. I used to work at WEBB, where the current mayor was my boss, who actually was my mother's student worker, is how life is cyclical. Kathy Pugh, the mayor of Baltimore, was my mother's student worker at Morgan. Years later, I'm her employee at WBB, and I didn't go interviewing for the job through her. I didn't even know, but it's interesting. So
there's so many Baltimore connections like that. So many people who've come on this podcast have had similar stories of knowing each other.
Guess who my first program director was? Kwaisi Mfume.
Oh, that's right.
At Morgan State, when he was, I got him as he was leaving. He was running for Congress. And he was still city councilman, and I got him as he was leaving. So yeah, I mean, I have crossed paths with a lot of great people, and it's been amazing here in Baltimore.
Growing up, were you a news junkie?
No. Really, technically, if you really want to dig in the weeds of it, I should not be in news at all. My father, first of all, in my home, we would listen to WBAL, or WSID, WANN Annapolis. We'd listen to all the stations, but primarily news. And at night, when we had three stations, that's it. When they came up around 5 or 6 in the morning, you saw the American flag, and they sang the national anthem. And then at night, at midnight, or 1 o'clock in the morning, you get bars, until the next morning. and you'd hear the thing at 10 o'clock, do you know where your children are? I grew up at that time, and my dad used to watch the 6 p.m. news. He'd come home and sit back in his recliner and watch the news with Walter Cronkite. That's the way it was. I'm like, Dad, why are you always watching the news? And I'm thinking it's you know, it's a lot because it was just for that moment. But my gosh, think about this, the 24/7 news cycle now. And he told me then, when it was just those moments for TV with Walter Cronkite, he was like Uncle Walter in the house, you know. He said, April, I'm watching the news because I want to know when the world comes to an end. You don't tell a child that. So I should have run in the opposite direction, but for some strange reason, and I'm strange like that, I ran to it instead of from it. So.
And you've been trying to figure out when the world will end ever since?
I pray it doesn't end any time. Well, I've been trying to figure out the world, not when it's going to end, but just trying to figure out the world.
So what led you to Morgan and then ultimately to political reporting?
My mother worked at Morgan for 42 and a half years before her death 10 years ago. And I wanted to go somewhere else, but she fell ill, and it just worked out that I went to Morgan and stayed with her and helped her. That summer she got better. We didn't know she was sick, and then she got sick, and then it was gone, and I went to Morgan. And I wanted to go to a bigger campus, but I'm so thankful that it worked out the way it did, because I was able to do hands-on with Morgan, you know, go to WEAA, be on the air, go to the carrier current or whatever it's called now. It was my training ground for being on the air, for using that microphone, using my voice. And I wish, and the sad thing is, if I would have gone to a larger school, I think, which I wanted to do, I don't think I would have had the access that I did at Morgan. I wanted to be in TV. I said, oh, well, I guess I'm not going to be in TV. And look, how many, about 30 years later, it's like, oh, you're in TV.
Yeah, full circle.
Yeah, how about that? I was fighting to be in TV, but I was the radio girl. But look, you know, you never know what God has in store.
What was it about radio that clicked for you as opposed to TV or print reporting?
You can play with your voice, theater of the mind, you know. I'm talking to you and you hear me and we're friends. You're driving or you're in your home and I'm talking to you. You know, it's not necessarily a conversation, but I'm talking to you. I'm giving you information. I'm making you happy. I'm giving you music. I'm doing whatever. I started out as a DJ, actually. But ultimately, I went into news. I like information. I like being in the midst of things, knowing what's going on, feeling it, tasting it, smelling it, bathing in it. And I think that's my plus, those are my pluses.
Before joining the White House press corps, you had not been a political correspondent, right?
Except for like little city hall stuff and, you know, local politics. But all politics is local, really. And I was very intimidated by it. And my boss said to me, he said, look at it as a larger version of city hall. And he was right. He really was right. If you really look at it every day, and I try not to, it could be intimidating and overwhelming. But you just take it, you take it in bites and just do it. But if I stop back, and some days I don't like looking at my resume or my bio, particularly my bio, because I'm like, wow, you did that. I'm like, huh? You just do it and don't think about it. It's not about building a resume. It's not about getting accolades. It's just like you just do it. And that's when it falls into place, if you love what you do. And along the way, if you love what you do, you accrue these things. And I just don't like looking because I'm like, wow, it gets intimidating. Or if I really look at the scope and magnitude of the place that I walk in every day, I'm like, oh my God, I'll be intimidated. I try to keep it in perspective at all times.
And your tiny little office helps you keep it in perspective, I would imagine.
Tiny is not the word. You know, those tiny houses that they're building on DIY that I watch all the time. Let me tell you something. Those are mansions compared to that little space that I have two phone booths put together. Prime real estate.
In your book, it sounds like you did not love what you were doing at first, though. You say that kept you motivated, but how did you get to that point, and how were you able to stay motivated in the beginning when you weren't liking the White House scene?
My mother, I wanted to quit. She said, no, you have got to stay there for 2 years at least, because people will think you got fired. So I've stayed there 2 plus 18. It was tough at first because I was a new kid. I didn't understand a lot of the things that were grandfathered in. I didn't understand the rhythms. I didn't understand some of the language, but I learned it. I learned it the hard way, and it worked out. And I've been with the network. They continue to like me. They continue to renew my contract. So I'm like, okay. So I stay. But it's not, it's, you know, people tell me, you know, in this business now, these young people, oh, I want to be like you. I'm like, you don't know what that really encompasses. You see this, you know, you might see this, what it looks like, glitter. And I'm thinking about my daughter's little glitter slime that she likes to make. You think about the glitter, but there is that slime on the other side. You know, the retaliation if you question someone or get something that they didn't want you to get, or just calling sources. I mean, you may see me on TV, you may hear me in the briefing room or see me in the briefing room, but behind that, there is 24/7 work. You know, you don't sleep a lot of times. A lot of us who are really dedicated to this, like you are, Quinn, you're emailing, calling your sources. I mean, for instance, this morning, last night, do you know when I went to bed about 2 a.m.? I was doing a report, two reports at midnight and 1 a.m. Get up at 6 o'clock. I slept late today. And as soon as I get up, I'm looking at the news, looking at my phone and reaching out to my contacts and trying to make sure that I'm on the pulse of what's happening. I mean, it could be healthcare. It could be President Trump doesn't like one of his cabinet officials. It could be some of the former administration striking back at this administration for some of the things that they are saying. It could be a whole gambit of things, but anything and everything presidential. It could be Ivanka Trump having a new line of clothes and there's a problem with the emoluments clause. It could be Trump International. People, you know, their credit card numbers are being stolen. It could be all of that, you know? But then again, it could be something totally different. But I have to be. It's like constantly, constantly studying for a master's or a doctorate degree. Let's say doctorate degree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think part of that perception comes from, I kind of feel like there's like a 1% of journalists and then the 99%, you know, it's like some of the public's only exposure might be to those really high level elite broadcasters who probably have big cushy salaries, but that's really not the reality for the rest of the journalists.
It's not the reality. You know, I'm a reporter who basically, I have to do my own research and I rely on sources and getting the facts right. And I call my sources. I mean, they'll tell you, I don't go through PR people. I'll grab you myself and I'll have that conversation with you. And then I'll say, hey, can we go on the record? And one thing that my sources will tell you, and I've learned this, I didn't realize that when you call, like, let's say a newsmaker, let's say Smokey Joe was congressman from Baltimore. Smokey Joe. Smokey Joe, I'm the reporter and I call Smokey, I email Smokey Joe, Congressman Smokey Joe, Congressman Smokey Joe, will you give me an interview? And I didn't realize what reporters do is if they call the Congressman Smokey Joe, call them back, they automatically feel it's on the record. I'm like, no. And I found that out the hard way when I became the news and people would do. I said, no, this is off the record until, you know, but what I do is I'll talk to you off the record and say, look, you know, what can you say about this? Are you willing to talk? Whatever. They say, sure, let's roll tape. But I didn't realize I'm totally different from a lot of people out there. They want the information. They want it now. They want it. But that's not how I operate. So I think I'm a little different than a lot of people, but I'm the same in a lot of ways, but a little different.
Well, you brought up becoming part of the news, and I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, that's usually a pretty uncomfortable situation for reporters to be in, that they don't, you know, that they try to avoid at all costs. But there have been these pretty run-of-the-mill encounters, like you said, asking normal questions of Sean Spicer, for example, and then you have gone viral, I guess, multiple times.
Memes. My brother is like, oh, April, there's another meme of you.
Meme.
Like, oh, my God.
And then so what has that experience been like?
It's a double-edged sword, Quinn. And I'm going to tell you why. I've been doing it for 20 years. And like all of a sudden people are like, oh, you're that girl. And I'm like, but yeah, I'm actually that woman. But the problem is, my problem is with it is that this recognition has come for something not so good. But my friends were telling me, they said, look, I said, you know, a lot of times things happen, things are, or people are thrust into the spotlight for things that are not so good, but they rise to the occasion to change a dynamic. And I said, okay, I like that. But it's not easy. And I think back to something my mother told me. She said, it's not what they call you, it's what you answer to. And when the shaking of the head thing happened, you know, I said, I was kind of upset about it, but I said, because I did go on Twitter, I said, Lord.
Yeah.
And people are like, what does that mean? Somebody said, well, that is the urban vernacular for the word Lord. I was like, Lord. And I didn't realize the moment. I didn't realize what was happening on Twitter. And I didn't realize. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. And people just kept going with it. And then it wound up being black women at work. And I was like, oh, gosh. And then Congresswoman Maxine Waters was having her issue. And Sean Spicer had, you know, she had her issue with Bill O'Reilly and about her physicality, hair comment. And then I had my shaking of the head thing with Sean Spicer after several incidents that already happened. But I'm like, you know, I didn't do anything. So typically we're not the news. But I said, you know what? In the time when people are trying to discredit us, trying to say we are fake, we are the enemy of the people, I said, I will not allow people to write a narrative about me. So I got out in front of it. And I'm not going to let you, I've seen it too often where people say, oh, well, you know, the good outweighs the bad. Yeah, it does. But you also have to remember, if you keep saying something, it's going to stick if you don't say something about it. So at that point, I had to say, this is my reputation. This is my livelihood. And I had to speak out. And I said, it wasn't speaking out against, it was just giving voice to the situation. I had nothing to run and hide from.
In a way, it seems that you and Congresswoman Waters have almost become like a representation to some people of how the current administration might treat women, might treat people of color. I mean, are you kind of comfortable with that position or with that interpretation?
Let me say this to you. I don't walk around saying I am the representative. If that's what you think, that's what you think. I'm doing my job. I, again, when that happened, I was shocked to see what was going on Twitter. I didn't even know that Hillary Clinton had spoken out until I got home, because I was like, oh my gosh, this day has been a lot. And I had to go tell my children, you know, this is what's happening, because they were going to find out about it, because they are big on social media. But my thing is, people placed me there, and I thank them for thinking of me that way. And I thank them for thinking of me as someone who they want to look to as to, this is how it's done when you are placed in an unsavory, unfavorable position on your job. And that's actually my job, my workplace. But I rose to the occasion to be respectful and keep moving. And people kept saying, how did you do it? I'm like, why wouldn't I do it that way? I can't get up there and curse him out because I stand on too many shoulders. But being a representative, I just continue to walk. I thank them. I'm not an advocate journalist. I'm a journalist. So if people want to look to me, I thank them. I'm honored. I'm more than honored. I'm humbled. But I'm going to continue to be me. I'm not in the resist movement. I will report on the resist movement. But I thank them for looking to me as an example, a shining example of how to deal with an unsavory situation on the job. I'm thankful.
Do you think your role has changed in covering this administration?
No, not at all. I do the same thing I've been doing. The only thing that's different is the fact that we have a president and an administration that really has taken the friendly adversarial relationship and flipped it upside down and taken the word friendly out of it. They're warring on us. We're not warring on them.
Your book came out in 2015 about covering three presidencies, and now you're on number four. I'm curious if a part of you wishes you could have held out and included your relationship with President Trump in that book as well.
Well, I'm glad you say that, Quinn, because we have updated the presidency in black and white, my up-close view of three presidents and race in America. It's now the presidency in black and white, my up-close view of four presidents and race in America. We did an epilogue, but it happened when it was supposed to happen. You know, it happened when it was supposed to happen. People never thought that race was as big as it was. And people are reading and seeing. It really is. Is it on the radar? How is it on the radar? If it is on the radar, what are the presidents going to do about it? It's always on the table for one way or the other, good or for bad. And for instance, it's on the table here in Baltimore with this president because, you know, U.S. Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein supposedly is from Baltimore, a city with very few Republicans. So, I mean, that was a slam to Baltimore, and it was very ugly. And some people switched the word Republicans or looking at it like, oh, you're trying to say that's a city that doesn't, that has a constituency that does not favor you. So many people are looking at it in so many different ways. So, you know, it is what it is. It is what it is. But I think race is always on the table. For instance, again, with Baltimore, you have the NAACP having their convention in Baltimore. The president of the United States says he's not going to come, declines. None of his administration is coming, whereas you've had presidents dating back to, I'm going to say my time at the White House, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and their administrations have come to speak to the nation's oldest civil rights organization. Race is on the table. African Americans have the highest numbers of negatives in almost every category. And that's not myth, it's not conjecture, it's real. And you, as the leader of the free world, as the president of the United States who covers all America, you're not coming. That is a story by itself. You know, that is book worthy, you know, and some other nuances with it. So I'm writing another book too. So the presidency in black and white, we've got an update. But the next book, I'm having a tough time with this one because I'm trying to write it without emotion. I'm trying to write it without emotion.
In the broad strokes, how have you seen the national conversation around race change since you started political reporting in Clinton's administration?
There used to be a tolerance. There used to be a sensitivity. I mean, of course, there are people who, there was a division. It's always going to be a division. But there were people who would say things, but now it's worse. Over the years, it's gotten worse. When I say it's gotten worse, we see it more so. It's more evident, more prevalent. It's on social media. It's in the news more. It's leading, okay? And some of the reasons now is because this president does not believe in being politically correct. So a lot of people are following his lead because he's the president of the United States. He is supposedly our moral leader as well, you know? So they're going to follow his lead. And, you know, it comes straight from the head. And now people are making no bones about their disdain, their anger, their fears, their what have you. It's real. It's out there and it's open. I mean, I even see since there's been this shift, I see more road rage. It's crazy. You know, just people aren't as welcoming to one another. Because I think people are like, oh, you are one of those or you're one of them. Everybody's now in this category, has a label on them instead of being just one people, you know. And I saw it with President Obama. But, you know, people would automatically assume, oh, you're one of them. So why? Because I'm black. But there are labels now that are really evident. Oh, I don't know.
And you hear all the time people blaming President Obama for creating divisions, but that's basically just by virtue of him being black. I don't understand where that argument comes from.
It's a sad day. We have to grow. We have to grow. And we're here together. And, you know, from the moment that Barack Obama became president of the United States, there were people who did not want him as president. You know, Rush Limbaugh said he hoped he failed, but he amended that. But he hoped he failed. He said it, though. You had Mitch McConnell talking about he wants to make sure he gets out of there, wants to get him out there, out of there. So you had people early on saying that. And there were other people. Those were people who were bold enough to speak their mind. And you had other people saying things. So the division, I didn't hear Obama saying things like that. I heard others saying that. But there was an evident division, but it's growing. And some of the reason why this president has garnered the support that he has is because he played on that division from certain sectors with the birther movement. So, you know, he is, though, the president of the United States. And there is a respect that's due him. But there's also an accountability piece. And when you see it, you know, you report on it.
You have a chapter about this in your book, but I was hoping you could talk about being in the, quote, specialty media and the kind of responsibility that comes with reporting on specialty issues, or in your case, questions around race that might not otherwise get asked.
So every day I'm in the briefing room and I'm part of the White House press corps who has a hard pass and workspace and a seat in the briefing room. So what happens is that I am on the third row, and pretty much by the time they get to me, a lot of the questions have been asked. The mainstream questions, you know, the Syria, the Russia, the this, the that. But when there's a question about Baltimore, nobody's going to ask it but me. When there's a question about Flint, no one else is going to ask it but me, pretty much. You know, if there's a police-involved shooting thing, me, you know, these things. So that's where specialty media comes in. We have a different niche. I focus in on all things, but primarily urban news with a concentration on Black America. So that's what specialty media is. And then you have other people who are there who are for the LGBT community or the religious community or the Hispanic community or women, or, you know, that's what specialty media is versus the overall umbrella of everyone.
What kind of responsibility comes with being, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the only Black female reporter in the White House Corps covering urban issues?
Again, I just walk in, Quinn. I just do my job. And if you think about it, it's like, wow, you just do it. Because if I sit back and say, oh, my God, I'd be scared. There's a lot of responsibility. It's also, you know, it's overwhelming. But, you know, when there is something that's going on in this nation or around the world, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask. Particularly when it comes to Black America, because a lot of times, when I first came to the White House, you didn't hear about a lot of urban issues, and people thought I was militant. I'm like, why? Because I'm asking those questions? So the mindset has shifted, because it is, I mean, it is now, someone said, Joy Reid said it's now cool to ask urban questions. So she said on Twitter one time, I remember a time when April Ryan used to be the only one asking about minority in urban America. Now everybody else is. So it's a little bit more accepted now.
Do you have any frustrations about how some other reporters or outlets have covered this administration? Or is there anything you'd like to see more of in overall coverage?
All sides of the story. I would like to see, and I would even like to see the president offer up some interviews to some of us to include me in my story. So I want some of the reporters that are, some of the new reporters that are there to really understand the dynamic, because we got an influx of new people that came into the briefing room. Understand that really the give and take. It's not just a fight. But some of these reporters, when they come in, they think it's all about them. You know, if they want to fight, and it's about them. No. It's about the American public. We're the first line of questioning an American president, whatever question we ask. But what happens is that those questions are funneled back into the community to help them understand their life or understand what's going on in their pocketbook, whatever's happening for them. So it's not about us. But I think there's so many different dynamics that come into play when you think about reporters and White House correspondents.
You mentioned covering all sides of the story. Mm-hmm. Working in journalism, I'm always curious to talk to journalists about this because, you know, there's what every journalist is taught is to cover both sides of the story, cover both sides equally. But I'm kind of curious about the question of objectivity and false balance, because especially when you have a scenario where the president might say something that is just unequivocally untrue, for example, it might just be factually wrong. And I feel like you kind of have this one camp who says, oh, we have to have both sides, you know, fair and balanced.
But what if you have to have both sides, but you also have to put out there that he said it, and you also have to fact check
right.
And find out if it's real or not. You put out all sides. You put out what the president said. You put out all sides, have them go back and forth on it in your piece. But then you also say, look, according to so-and-so, this is what happened. You know, you get the factual the more credible source that people are willing to understand and listen to as to what really the situation is.
What do you see as the role of the president, whoever the president may be, to dictate conversations around race?
When you're in a power position like that, or any power position at the White House, or even in Congress, or in state and local government, power means service and serving people, helping people. And if that's not the case, there's a problem. So whatever you do, it should be mostly about helping people. And when we as reporters listen to them, that's the ear that we're listening to. That's the ear that we're listening for or with. The ear of how is this affecting people? How is this helping people? And if it's not, that's when the back and forth, the tense verbal sparring begins, you know? But that's the way I look at politics in the highest office in the land.
Do you remember what your impression of a White House correspondent was before you became one, and how
Helen
the reality...
Helen Thomas, Sam Donaldson, Ann Compton. Helen Thomas, Sam Donaldson, and Ann Compton. Sam would scream, and I think I have the vocals of Sam Donaldson. Helen Thomas, I remember her in her red all the time with President Reagan. She'd get the first question. She was the epitome of White House correspondent. Also, let me add Gwen Ifill, the late Gwen Ifill. She was amazing in everything she did in reporting, and so was Ann Compton. So those are the people that I think of before me and that I look to.
How has your actual experience compared to what you thought it would be like?
It's a lot more work, and it's not as glamorous as you may think. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of studying. It's a lot of calling your resources and fact-checking and getting information. It's a lot.
The White House press corps is kind of in a unique position in that your office is in the White House, right?
Yeah, the West
yes.
Wing.
And, you know, you're with the same people every day. You're almost embedded in a certain way. And I wonder if relationships either with sources or does it ever feel too chummy, too close to, you know, inside job? I think of, for example, the criticism every year that the White House Correspondents' Dinner gets. And I'm wondering if you ever see that.
Let me tell you something. I used to be on the board of the association. I want that dinner. And I don't think it gets chummy. It's our time to let our hair down for one weekend out of the year, to bring our sources in, to talk to the politicians. It's our time to just basically let off steam and just push aside, you know, the year and just come together to laugh. And then we go back to the beat that night or even the next day, or sometimes we get information there. So, you know, it's about information gathering always, but also working and building relationships at that dinner. But that dinner is primarily about the next generation and scholarships and the First Amendment, supporting the First Amendment, freedom of the press. So it's not about the chummy. It's about supporting what we believe in and what is part of the framework of this nation, freedom of the press.
Is drawing that line ever difficult for you when you are interacting with these people all the time?
No, you saw that.
Yeah.
You saw that when President Trump asked me to get the CBC meeting. That's not my place. I'm very clear on who I am and where, how far I can go. Now, don't get me wrong. I will ask a newsmaker to have off the record with black journalists. I've done that before. I will do it again. I've done it with presidents. I've done it with other politicians. I will do it again. But as far as getting two government agencies together, government to government together, that's not my place. It's unethical, in my opinion.
In the beginning of your career, was it difficult to develop a thick skin?
Yes. I just gained a thick skin not long ago. It's like, oh, well.
How do you think you came to that point? And did you kind of like realize it? Did anything click with you where you felt like you were getting in more of a groove with your career?
No, it was when I said, you know, whatever. Because you're going to always have people who don't like you, or have something to say, or try to make something what it's not. And I'm just like, okay, whatever, bye. You know? You know, it's part of this crazy game dynamic, whatever you want to call it.
What hasn't changed since you started covering presidents in 1997?
What hasn't changed? The fight for news, the fight for truth, the fight for access to the president or his principles. Information, the fight for information has not changed. But what has changed? The delivery system, Twitter. You got a president who's tweeting up a storm and actually sometimes creating his own holes to jump in. You know, the delivery system is different. Sometimes we get press releases through social media. You know, it kind of started a little bit with Obama, but now it's in full swing. You know, social media happened. It changed the game.
Do you hope to cover more presidents in the future?
I'm getting older. and I'm tired. And I got kids. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, the ride has been good. I would have never imagined I'd been here for four presidents. You know, we'll see if he goes 8 or 4 years. And we'll see if there will be number five in my future. But it's a long time. So in 8 years, oh my gosh, I don't even want to talk about how old I'll be.
Ooh. So wow. You said we'll see if he goes 4 or 8 years. In what way would that influence your decision making? You want to stay for all 8 years or you want to get out after the four?
Well, let me say this. He hasn't even gone in a year yet. And, you know, you want to kind of get in the first year of a president if you're going to leave. I mean, I have no plans at this point to leave. But who knows? I mean, who knows? Who knows? You know, Like I said, I am getting older. You know, I started in my 20s, but and it consumes all of your life. It really does. You know, your life is kind of on hold in a lot of ways.
What sacrifices have you made for this job?
The time, you know, late nights, you know, sometimes I'm very deliberate when I'm with my kids about my time with my kids because this is so consuming and it's taken a lot. It's taken its toll on me, but I make sure that my children always know that I'm there. They have access to me at all times, be it if I'm in the house, be it if I'm at the studio, be it if I'm at the White House. So that's, I think, the home life. You know, my personal life has been affected. But when we play hard. And when we play deliberately. Yeah.
You have the books on the horizon. Is there anything else you want to do going forward?
I don't know. I never imagined that I would see a year like this with all the good, the bad, the ugly, and the indifferent. Never thought I'd have a book, let alone two. I'm working on a third. I never thought that I would be a CNN political analyst. I never imagined in my wildest dreams that I'd be Journalist of the Year by the NABJ. I never imagined, and this shook me to the core, I was crying on stage, that I would get an honorary doctorate from my own university at the same time former Vice President Joe Biden was getting his. That was amazing. And for a kid from Baltimore. I never imagined all this. I mean, anything can happen. If we just gotta believe in ourselves and have hope and just keep on fighting the good fight and just be and just do. You know, I think we'll be okay. I mean, I don't do this for accolades. I just do what I do. I've been doing it for 20 years. Just putting one foot in front of the other and just going. And it's coming around me. I'm like, wow. And it's just, you know, some days I'm brought to tears from, you know, people on the street or when I get an award or something. And I'm like, standing ovations? Me? You know? I'm getting a little teary-eyed talking about it now. But I'm just thankful.
Thanks so much for coming in, April.
Thanks, Quinn.
Thanks for listening to Female Trouble, a podcast spotlighting some of Baltimore's most interesting and accomplished women. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. You can find Female Trouble everywhere you like to listen to podcasts and online at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. We're also on Twitter at FMLTrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty featuring TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll be back next week with a new episode.